Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, I'm still intrigued by the magic of the little device that I have in my car that can I can put the address in and it'll give me directions all the way through. It's a GPS, global positioning system, I guess, device. Guides every step. The other thing it does, it has the potential at least to tell the world where I am at any time. This kind of thing would have been unimaginable a few years ago, and now we take it for granted. So where did it come from? How did it get here? And Eric Frazier, who's a co-author of a book called GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs to Smartphones, came to answer those questions for me. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you have a close connection to the Carolina community because your sister works here. Diane is a very popular member right. of our community.
And my son is a UNC graduate, honors graduate.
Honors graduate. Well, yes. You don't look at yourself old enough to be having
children. Oh, gosh, he's my youngest.
Wow. Well, Eric, first of all, let's talk. What is GPS?
Well, the Global Positioning System is a system of satellites orbiting the Earth in what is known as mid-altitude orbit, 12,500 miles. And as we say in the introduction, it can probably best be thought of as a series of free radio signals, and they continually essentially broadcast a message that includes very precise time. That's why GPS satellites each carry multiple atomic clocks on them. And the uses for this time code that the GPS satellites broadcast started off to serve the military, but it was foreseen from the very beginning that there would be many commercial.
What did the military want from the times that the satellites were giving it?
Well, what the military wanted to do was to be able to navigate to a specific place and then drop ordnance on a specific place. There was the Air Force had a motto in the Joint Program Office. It was a joint program amongst the different military departments, but the Air Force was the executive agency. So the Air Force has always run the system for the entire military. And they wanted the ability to drop five bombs in the same hole. And that was sort of the selling point at the very beginning to get funding.
So they knew from the beginning that if they put satellites up that could tell or could transmit accurate time, that they could use those that information to drop bombs in the same hole. They knew that at the beginning?
Oh, yes. That was the number one driving purpose at the outset. Of course, being able to navigate an airplane or a ship or a tank to a specific place to fire was also extremely important. So in the military, knowing where you are is vital to not only to shoot weapons, to aim weapons, but to know where your comrades are and to avoid shooting each other. That was one of its best and early benefits in the Persian Gulf War.
Well, how did they know before they got started with it that the system of satellites flashing time down to Earth would be able to tell them where to provide a geographic directional location?
Well, really the way global satellite navigation, today we have GPS in the United States and then other countries are building their own and they've come to be known as GNSS or Global Navigation Satellite Systems. The way this came about really followed Sputnik. There were at least three individuals or groups that tracked Sputnik, and they used receivers on the ground to track the satellite going around the Earth. And it became evident pretty quickly that if you inverted the process, you could use a signal from a satellite not to determine where the satellite was, but to also determine where the receiver was. And to do so, you require a certain number of satellites. You need 3 satellites to determine your position on the ground, but if you're moving above the ground, like in an airplane, you really need 4. And you use the 4th as a check on your clock, because timing is everything. It's a combination of timing and trigonometry, basically.
Well, explain, as you do in the book, how it is that if you have 3 different signals of time coming to one point, that you can use that information to tell you where you are. How does that work?
Well, the way it works depends upon some incredibly brilliant mathematical computations that are today performed on computer chips. And really what we talk about in the book is that so many technologies came together to make all this possible, the miniaturization. First you had to have the space program. You had to have advanced electronics, communications, video screens, antennas. So many things have come together. But to get back to the way it works, the satellites beam down this time code, and they're sending a stream of information, data bits, digital information, that repeats, but it has this precise time code in it. Receivers have multiple channels, and they receive these signals from different satellites. When they receive a signal, the receiver begins to repeat the signal. And as I describe it in Chapter 5, it's kind of like people singing in the round, row, row, row your boat, and somebody else says, row, row, row your boat, and you hear them at the same time. Then the receiver begins to slow down its own repetition until it synchronizes with the incoming signal. That difference in slowing down, and when we describe that, it sounds like something we could hear or think about, but we're talking about minute fractions of a second here. But all the signals travel through space at the speed of light. So that's a constant. So the receiver, when it can tell how long the signal took to get from the satellite to where the receiver is, it can use math with the constant of the speed of light to determine how far away the satellite is. At any one time, your GPS receiver is receiving signals from satellites that are located in different parts of the sky overhead. You can't see them, but they're out there, and they're all somewhat differently located. And by using those differences in the distance, the receiver can determine exactly where it is, either on the surface of the Earth or above it.
So it gets to be almost a plane geometry sort of computation, in the sense that if you know the angles and the distances, you can figure out location.
Correct. And so it requires this incredible instantaneous math. Before the GPS satellites were in orbit, there was a prior system called Transit that was developed directly out of tracking Sputnik.
We're visiting with Eric Fraser, who's the co-author of GPS Declassified. He's trying to help us understand how the Garmins and the other devices that got us around work. And you're doing a good job, but we'll do more after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Eric Fraser. He's the co-author with Richard Easton of a book called GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs to Smart Phones. And I want you to talk, Eric Fraser, a little bit about the history, and maybe the way to do that is for you to talk about your co-author and his father. Would that can you tell us the contribution that Richard Easton's father had to this bringing together of all this technology, mathematics, and miniaturization of our hardware.
Well, my co-author, Richard Easton, lives in Chicago. His father, Roger Easton, lives in New Hampshire. He's past 90 now. Roger Easton, during the Second World War, toward the end of it, was working for the Naval Research Laboratory, doing research into things like blind aircraft landings using radars and such. When the Sputnik era came along, he was involved in Project Vanguard. And so he and some of his colleagues at the Naval Research Laboratory designed the very first satellite that the United States ever attempted to launch, the Vanguard satellite. He also designed...
And we had a little trouble getting that Vanguard satellite.
The Vanguard satellite program was, as we say in the book, was extraordinarily successful. In a short, little more than 3 years, launched many successful rockets and put up several satellites. And in fact, the Vanguard satellite that was launched on St. Patrick's Day in 1958 is still orbiting and is the oldest man-made object in space. And it is unknown. No one can predict when it will come down. So it is still in such a stable orbit that the estimates range from 200 to 2,000 years.
Well, is it still doing anything?
No.
I guess. What were those satellites? What were their tasks?
Well, it was satellites? A scientific effort. At that time, this was the public and scientific face of the race between the U.S. and the USSR to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles. So the military was sending up longer and longer range missiles that could carry warheads, while the scientists wanted to get satellites into space to do studies of for scientific purposes, geodesy, to be able to look at the Earth's gravitational field. In fact, those first satellites told us that the Earth is not a perfect sphere, but is a little bit more pear-shaped than people realize. But what Roger Easton and his colleagues did, they built Vanguard, they built Minitrack, which was a system to track it. And then the Russians...
What did they... to track... how did that work?
Well, they built... it was part of the International Geophysical Year. And so they had agreed on these radio frequencies that would be little beeps, and scientists could all over the world could track the satellites. But the Russians decided to use a different frequency. And they launched Sputnik sort of preemptively. It set off a panic, as history tells us, in this country. And one of the things that's interesting was that there wasn't a rush, precisely, to change the plan of launching Vanguard. But there was a lot of pressure to get a satellite up as soon as possible. And so the very first Vanguard attempt is now what you can see on YouTube if you search it as an infamous, the rocket rises up about 4 feet and then collapses in a fireball. Well, that first satellite, that Vanguard satellite, fell to the ground, survived maybe a 6-story fall, thousands of gallons of water, a conflagration, was still beeping its little signal.
Oh, is that right?
Marty Votaw, the one of
this was the
1957
a signal thing in Mr. Easton's career that he was working on the satellite. Is that what
he designed the satellite and the tracking system? He went on to design space surveillance, which was the Navy system to track spy satellites, because once satellite launches became common, they realized that they weren't going to have beeps. They were going to be orbiting north to south, whereas the Earth turned, they would be able to take pictures of the landmass underneath. The original satellites were launched sort of like with the equator to try to get a boost from the Earth's rotation. So they wanted to be able to detect a spy satellite that wouldn't be making any signals. And so they built a space fence with three large transmitters and three large receivers, and it shot signals into space in a fence across the southern United States, what's known as a fan beam. Any satellite that it encountered, the signal would bounce back and be detected.
Sounds like a sonar type.
It's called a bistatic radar is what it's called. So that space surveillance system actually is where Roger Easton developed the idea to put a very accurate clock in the satellite, because they had an atomic clock that they had in a truck, and they would drive it from one – it's to accurately predict where the satellite is in orbit meant that all of these six stations had to be have their time perfectly synchronized. So they were driving a clock. They tried to send the signal from one station to the other, but the signal was noisy and the horizon, you know, it was too far. It was over the horizon. It distorted the signal too much. So they took an atomic clock and drove it from one station to the next. But even syncing them that way, there was enough difference that he started thinking, you know, if I had a really good clock, even an atomic clock, in the satellite overhead, it could send the time signal down to both of these stations and sync them at the same time, and the system would be that much more accurate. That got him to developing the notion of 24 satellites with three spares circling the Earth with atomic each one with an atomic clock, able in any weather, anywhere in the world, to guide ships and airplanes to their destination.
Well, now that's the leap that I want you to back up and guide me across this leap, because he wanted the 24-hour comprehensive surveillance by the our presence of the satellites in the sky, so that it covers the whole Earth, and so that you'd be able to send from the satellites, or a signal with the accurate time could be picked up anywhere, and it would be right. The same time everywhere in the world. Now, all right, I see the usefulness of having everybody on the same time, but I don't see how that enabled Mr. Easton to say, okay, now I can tell where everything is in the world. I can locate everything, or I can give people the ability to determine their location based on these time signals. Who told him that? Who told him about that? Or did everybody just know that?
Well, they began testing this immediately after Sputnik. And the early systems used the change in the Doppler. You know, when everybody's familiar with an ambulance going by and it appears to change pitch. So they could actually, as the satellites were beeping and the beep changed pitch, that was even enough to be able to roughly position things. But
so they knew that immediately, or they knew that before they were even up there, that if you had three satellites.
And they tested it on the ground as well. We have a story about some of the NRL scientists out on the road in a van parked with their receiving equipment, and they put the transmitter in a convertible and sent one of the guys off down a highway that had just opened. There was no traffic on it. It was 495 or something, might have been the Beltway. And so he takes off, and they're taking their readings, and a policeman pulls up, and he says, "What are you guys doing?" Well, actually, at that time, they already had one of the satellites up. I'm sorry, that was a different time. But they did these tests from the ground. But when you can imagine, they were in the back of this van with a bunch of oscillators, you know, screens with little round, looked like little round TVs with little green signals on them. And the policeman said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "We're waiting for our satellite to come up over the horizon." And they tried to explain it to him. Finally, he said, "Good luck," and he left. But they first did it on the ground, sending receivers off in a car. And then they did finally in 19, in the late 60s and the early 70s, there were one or two at different times satellites that they were putting up to test.
We're visiting with Eric Fraser, who's a co-author of GPS Declassified, talking about global positioning, about Garmin's and other GPS devices. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Eric Frazier, who is the co-author of GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs, Smart Bombs to Smartphones. And Eric, during the break, we talked a little bit about what it's like today, and that many of us don't even have any idea of the impact of the GPS system as it relates to the cell phones that we've got, or the smartphones that we've got, and other things. But before we go there, will you tell us a little bit about how people tried to find out where they were before we had the GPS system? What did the Navy and people who were looking for location, did they have any tools at all?
Oh, humans have been quite ingenious about navigating for thousands of years. We have a chapter that covers, it's called a Brief History of Navigation. In the beginning, people used landmarks to find their way around and of course, over time, our mode of transport has become faster and faster, which is what has driven our need to have more precise tools to navigate. So, when people walked from place to place, they had trees or mountains or, stone outcroppings. Maybe they'd blaze a trail. They could, tie a little piece of leather around a tree limb or take a machete and make a mark on a tree. When humans began sailing vessels and got out onto the ocean where there were no landmarks nearby, they made much more use of something that was somewhat used when they were traveling, by land, which was the constellations. And so for thousands of years, people have been using celestial navigation to move about, using the location in the sky of stars at various seasons, and particularly the sun, the moon, and the moons of planets like Jupiter, and using the angles to find where they were. Now, this advanced sort of up through the 17th, 18th centuries, but you still had ship navigators being quite accurate with latitude using the sextant, for example. But until they knew what time it was, they had a hard time determining their longitude. So when they were sailing east-west, they would find that they would be off quite a bit. And the reason is because clock technology depended on things like pendulums. And you couldn't take a clock that had a pendulum swinging out on a ship because the roiling seas would make it inaccurate. So they started using springs. Well, clock would run fast in the beginning and get slower and slower at the end, and worse, the springs would rust. So John Harrison, who is the subject of Dava Sobel's wonderful book, Longitude. Spent his life trying to perfect a clock that would be up to the rigors of travel at sea, and succeeded. And what he created came to be called the marine chronometer. And really, GPS is the next great step because at that time, the contest for how to determine longitude was between accurate time, like the chronometer, and you had increasingly good telescopes and things like that. So there were astronomical ways to do it by looking at Jupiter's moons, and there's a lot of them, and they go behind Jupiter and are eclipsed and so forth. And so the astronomers made elaborate tables. So you had a celestial and a timekeeping solution, but GPS combines the timekeeping solution in a man-made celestial object.
Well, so. Eric Frazier, we're going to talk now about the consequences of all of this, and one of the consequences that comes to mind is who owns this system? What is who determines it? It looks like it's just up there and anybody can use it.
Yes, it's free. The signals are free to anybody who has a receiver. But as I say, freedom is not free. GPS is not really free. Who owns it? You and I own it. The U.S. taxpayers own it.
But now anybody in the world can use it.
Yes. And it was developed by the military, still controlled by the military, still funded through military spending. This is one of the things that I try to get across to people, that in casual conversation it comes up and they don't know, why should I be concerned about GPS? And I say, well, think of it this way. It's a piece of aging infrastructure that must be maintained not only by U.S. taxpayer dollars, but by military expenditures, because the military maintains it. And so when people think, yeah, we need to reduce military budgets, that sequestration is okay with me. Well, recently, the Air Force shut down the space fence that my co-author's father helped to build, and one of the things they cited was sequestration. And they have plans for a new elaborate system to replace it, but they didn't wait until they build that. It's not even approved yet. It could be 2 or 3, 4 years. And there are some other ways to track space objects with space-based systems, but from my understanding, that space fence that sent up that fan-shaped signal and detected things flying over was still the best way to see the objects that are 4 inches or smaller, which there are many, many of them. There are thousands of pieces of space debris up there today. So anyway, the U.S. taxpayers fund it to the tune of roughly about $1 billion a year. But a study that was done a couple of years ago showed that if you had a complete loss of the GPS signal, it could shave $96 billion a year off of our economy. At that time, that was about 0.7% of GDP. So it has cost a lot to develop it, but by all objective measures, it has contributed an enormous amount over the years to our economy, while also being extremely important in terms of defense.
Well, what about the other countries who might be using this system but thinking, well, we don't want to be dependent on the U.S. for our military? Do other groups have in mind competitive systems?
They're building
complementary systems.
They are building them and have been building them. The European Union is building Galileo. They have 4 satellites up now. This is a system that has been talked about for years and years. They talked about by 2015 having 30 satellites up. We have currently 31, 32 healthy satellites. Galileo is a long time coming. It has been behind, over budget and behind schedule for a long time, but eventually they probably will get it up. China was going to be part of that, and when Galileo was envisioned as a private enterprise and the financing kind of crumbled and it was taken over by the European Union, China saw they felt like they were getting sort of shut out politically. They started their own. They now have 14 operational satellites beyond the early test ones that they did. That system is called Baidu, sometimes called Compass. And they plan to have a total of 35 satellites up by 2020. They have it's operational over the Pacific Asian area of China. The only other truly global system is GLONASS, which is operated by the Russians. Not too long after we got GPS going, the Russians got GLONASS going. Then the Soviet Union, as it was then, collapsed. And during the 90s, they didn't build their satellites with a very long shelf life. We have our oldest satellite, which was designed for 7.5 years, is now running 23 years and 2.5 months. It's unbelievable that it's still healthy. But the Russian satellites were built to last 2-3 years, and that's about what they lasted. And GLONASS, by the end of the 90s, was decrepit. 2 or 3 satellites working. It wasn't working anymore. Then in the 2000s, they reinvigorated it, and they now have 29 satellites. I think I looked this morning. They have 29 healthy satellites going. So what you see now is receivers coming out that can pick up signals from GPS, GLONASS, China's Beidou. India and Japan are building regional constellations with highly inclined orbits so that the satellites are over their territory for more of the day. And it helps with things like aircraft travel. Recently, when India certified their Gagan service, it created a situation where you now have sort of seamless regional travel with the augmentations. This is something we haven't touched on yet, but
talk about that
beyond the basic GPS from the very early on.
I'll tell you what, Eric Frazier, let's take a quick break and then come back.
Okay.
I'm visiting with Eric Frazier. He's talking about Global Positioning System. He's the co-author of GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs to Smartphones. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Eric Frazier. He's the co-author of GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs to Smartphones. Eric, we're not out of time, but we don't have a lot of time. And so I want you to talk about what's really at the top of your mind. One of the things that you mentioned was that you didn't feel like the rest of us sort of had an appreciation of what was really going on with our smartphones and our tracking devices and all of this, and how it has will have an increasingly important impact on our lives. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, a lot of people don't realize that that GPS is essentially a public utility. What they do hear, they hear about the NSA tracking people, and I think it's important to point out in a setting like this that people should know that GPS by itself can't do any tracking. GPS sends a passive signal, just like your radio station. You can listen to it. You don't know who, you don't have a way here in the control room to know who's tuned in. GPS is the same way. However, once a GPS receiver receives the signals and establishes precise coordinates to tell you, here's where I am. Separate wireless technology can be used and sent somewhere else to somebody doing the tracking to say, here's where this person is. And that is what's happening with people's smartphones. Now, the reason that that came about was not some conspiracy by the NSA to spy on everyone, but from a very simple reason. In the 90s, as cell phones proliferated, these 911 call centers that we invested lots and lots of money in would pick up the phone and people would say, help, I'm hurt, or I need this, I need that. Back when there were landlines, an address popped up on their computer screen. When the calls started coming in from cell phones, people were off in the middle of nowhere. They had run off the road into a tree. They didn't know where they were. So the FCC gave the cell phone companies a certain amount of time, which they kept having to extend because the technology wasn't there at that point. But they said, you've got to come up with a technology to identify where this emergency call is coming from on the phone. So some of them primarily started off with triangulation of where the cell phone towers were. And you've probably seen that on a show like CSI where it pops up a graphic and they figure out where someone is. That doesn't work well in rural areas where there may not be 3 cell towers. You may be making your call and only getting 1 cell tower within view. So they also started working on having GPS in the cell phone. And so both of these have sort of come together, and it's a hybridized sort of solution now as to where you are on your phone. But it has created a situation where the telephone mobile carriers have all of this geolocation information on you. And so the question becomes, is this sort of breadcrumb trail that you have left, who does it belong to? Does it belong to the phone company? Does it belong to you? Obviously, you give the phone company the right to keep that information when you agree to use their service. But what people don't know in this NSA debate that's been going on is that absent the NSA, law enforcement agencies at all levels, from the FBI down to county sheriffs, have been making a million or more requests a year to phone companies for people's geolocation data to tie them, to check them out for crimes. I mean, and generally this is done because they have a particular suspicion. It's not the big haystack that the NSA has collected. But the fact of the matter is, the phone companies and many of the people who market to you have this information already. And so there's really not much of a way around it.
Yeah, well, let me interrupt you just for a second, because on a positive side of it, if I ever needed to figure out where I was a year ago today and my cell phone was operating, the information is in somebody's database now that would provide us the opportunity to track my movements throughout the day. I mean, I could reckon.
And I don't know how long individual phone companies keep that information, but people, one of the questions I wondered in writing the book was, well, how much data do they really have? And I found a place where a politician in the Green Party in Germany wondered the same thing. So he sued Deutsche Telekom to find out what they had. In a three-month period, they had 35,000 locational data points for him just in 90 days. So I don't know how long it's stored. I don't know how long the NSA stores there, but there's a massive amount of digital data stored in places about us.
A result is that, I didn't used to think God could do this, could keep up with millions of people and follow their goings and comings and then keep it all sorted out so that on Judgment Day, he or she would be able to tell us exactly what we've been done. But the thanks to the GPS and thanks to the development of equivalent types of information and transmission in our cell phones and other devices, it's perfectly
conceivable.
Conceivable, yeah, that not only God can do this, but human beings can do this.
Well, I personally don't know how much real-time tracking spy agencies can do. I think when they describe it as a haystack, I think that's literally what it is. I think they want a trove of information to go to that they can sort through with suddenly if something happens to try to make a connection without having to go through the laborious trouble of asking different phone companies for it. But, one of the things that's coming is, there was just a report on the evening news about it. We touch on it in the book, vehicle to vehicle and vehicle to infrastructure communications. So not only are all of us with our phones interacting and showing our locations, but imagine when all of the cars that we drive and all of the bridges we pass under are electronically chit-chatting with each other all the time. It's hard to wrap your mind around the amount of data that is
this thing that the president talks about, cars talking to each other. But now, Eric, you got to come back because we're out of time, and you just scratched the surface and increased our curiosity about what the GPS system is going to do. Thanks for putting together this wonderful background history of it, and then for sharing some of it with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest has been Eric Frazier. He's the co-author of GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs to smartphones. And Eric, we're going to put up your website. If you want to know more, website, gpsdeclassified.com. Thanks for listening.